Now, he was elected on Friday. He held his first cabinet meeting yesterday. Today he's in Scotland, later Northern Ireland and Wales tomorrow, and the United States on Tuesday. So it's a busy start for the new UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who's promised raw honesty with the public about the tough decisions ahead. Here, the Irish government will be hoping that the Starmer era will lead to a reset in British-Irish relations, including greater cooperation on Northern Ireland, immigration and trade. In 10 days' time, Keir Starmer will hold a former meeting with the Taoiseach Simon Harris at 10 Downing Street. The meeting will form part of a reset of the working relationship between Dublin and London, which had been badly damaged after Brexit. But what kind of a partnership will emerge? And are Anglo-Irish relations entering a new, more positive era? Jennifer Carroll McNeill is Minister of State for European Affairs. I spoke with her earlier and asked her what would be top of the agenda when Simon Harris meets Keir Starmer in 10 days' time.
I think the first and most important thing for the Taoiseach will be having that opportunity to sit down with the new British Prime Minister and, as you say, reset that relationship and begin again in a really positive way, looking forward to the future. These are two islands that will always be side by side with each other, sharing a common travel area. How can we work better together over the next number of years on all of the issues that face us, both the external threats that face us all and the internal issues, making Northern Ireland work really well, making Stormont work really well as co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, how we can work in a closer, deeper way to make sure that Northern Ireland is that great success that we all want it to be. So I think the Taoiseach is very pleased to see, you know, that the priority that's being placed by the new Prime Minister on the relationship with Ireland. There is an important European political community meeting on the 18th, and the meeting with the Taoiseach will take place before that, as well as a working dinner the night before that. So that's very clear to us, the emphasis and priority that the new British Prime Minister has placed on his relationship with Ireland, his priority with Ireland, and that certainly reflects the tone and the ambition of the Irish government and the Taoiseach in particular in resetting that relationship in a really structured and positive way for the future.
You say starting again in a positive way. How badly damaged is the relationship with the UK, particularly since Brexit?
We have always had a close relationship, and there were periods where it was incredibly strong back when the Queen was visiting us, 13 years ago. There's no question but that Brexit placed strain on the relationship because we have had to work through the practical issues of the United Kingdom coming out of the European Union. So we always want to begin again, and we always want to look forward. And this is an opportunity, as any new political relationship is, an opportunity to work constructively. We will always be neighbours. We will always be close friends. We will always have family sharing the two islands, and we want it to be a really positive relationship. We also want to be able to be constructive and supportive to the UK in any way that it wants to work more closely with the European Union. And, you know, those interests are so closely aligned for us. And certainly, say, for example, me as Minister for European Affairs want to be able to be constructive around any areas where the United Kingdom may wish to place emphasis on ironing out some practicalities with the relationship with the European Union for the future. Okay. So this is a moment of positivity. We're very pleased to see the emphasis that the British Prime Minister has placed on the relationship with Ireland, and also very pleased to see the focus on Northern Ireland. He's appointed an excellent minister now, Hilary Benn, as Secretary of State, who's there on the ground straight away. That's very constructive and positive. And I think this is an opportunity for both countries now to work closely and positively together.
And I want to ask you about Northern Ireland and the Northern Ireland Troubles Legacy Bill, which was enacted last September by the Tory government and which stopped criminal and civil investigations and inquests from going ahead which relate to the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and which was almost universally opposed by the parties in Northern Ireland. Is it the government's expectation that the new UK government will repeal that legacy bill?
Well, that legacy bill, as you know, was opposed by everybody in Northern Ireland, everybody in Ireland, and all of the political parties except for the Tory party in the United Kingdom. And it was very clear, you will have seen the Labour Party manifesto as much as I have seen it, that they have signalled an intent to make changes to that. And indeed, the early commentary reflects that intent in the manifesto. But I am very conscious that this is a new government who are trying to get their feet under the table. We've got to leave them space to do that. And it is up to them what they choose to do.
But you want them to do that.
we have been very clear about our view about the Legacy Act, that it is not the right approach. Unfortunately, the Irish government did have to initiate interstate proceedings in the ECHR against that legislation. But again, let the new British government settle in, get their feet under the table. Certainly, the commitments that they made in the manifesto and the early commentary, even in the last couple of days, has been very positive about where they may go with the Legacy Act. But the last thing I want to do now is step across them when they have an opportunity to get their feet under the table and actually get on with the work that they have promised to do across the board in their manifesto. But it does look as though this is the direction they may travel, and that would of course be very welcome for everybody on this island, and most importantly for the victims of the Troubles who need a different way of finding justice.
We heard Prime Minister Starmer say yesterday that he would scrap the Rwanda policy developed by his predecessors. Do you welcome that, and do you believe that it will lead to a decrease in the number of migrants who were coming from the UK into the Republic of Ireland via perhaps via Northern Ireland because perhaps they were afraid that they would be deported to Rwanda?
Well, again, domestic, you know, policy, you know, will be a matter for the new British government. Again, you'll have seen the commitments in the Labour Party manifesto. But I think where we have always been really concerned about is the operation of the common travel area. And that is something that we have enjoyed and has worked really positively for very many decades. And we wish it to for very many decades to come. Challenges have been thrown up towards the common travel area, both around questions around Brexit, you know, issues around the management of migration. And as these issues arise, we want to work constructively with every British government to managing the different issues as they arise. This has been one over the past number of months, and we now look forward to working with the new British government on maintaining all of the benefits of the common travel area that we have enjoyed together.
Do you expect the new UK government to take back asylum seekers who have come in to the Republic illegally, as something the Tories were refusing to do?
Well, again, this is a new government that from our perspective in Ireland, we want to allow them the space to implement their own domestic policy. We want to work constructively and we see a real opportunity to do that. So let me not step across them. Okay. Let them get under the feet under the table. The noises are good so far and we're there to work constructively. We're really pleased to see the emphasis that the new British Prime Minister has placed on the relationship with the Taoiseach and on making that real at a very early stage and prioritising, you know, space and time with the Taoiseach over, it could have been any other leader. It could have been anybody else coming to the European political community, you know, but he chose to prioritise Ireland, and we see that's the space we want to be in as well.
All right. Before I let you go, Minister, I want to ask for your reaction to the investigation by RTE Investigates and the Sunday Independent into allegations that coaches who are active in women's football engaged in inappropriate relationships with players and are also accused by some of them of making unwanted sexual advances on players. What is your reaction to what you have heard and read, and what do you think should happen next?
The revelations in this investigation are yet another example of the things that women have had to put up with in different ways, particularly women in vulnerable positions or, you know, with people in authority. And I think women up and down Ireland are absolutely sick and tired of it, both historically and in a current way, and it just has to stop.
That was the Minister for European Affairs, Jennifer Carol McNeill, speaking with me earlier. Let's stay with UK politics now, and we're joined by John Tong, Professor of Politics at the University of Liverpool. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the programme. Just going back, John Tong, to the result of the election on Friday, we saw the vote of the Tories gobbled up by Nigel Farage's party Reform and that landslide for Labour. But its share of the vote only increasing marginally from the last election. Is there anything for Keir Starmer to be concerned about in that fact?
I think there are things to be concerned about for Keir Starmer. The fact that he only got just over one third of the vote for his party is disappointing in one sense. It doesn't matter because, of course, he's got nearly two thirds of the seats in Parliament, and there isn't going to be, well, there may be a debate about the voting system in the UK, but when you've got a 174 seat majority as Prime Minister, you're not going to engage in that debate. But it wasn't an overwhelmingly resounding endorsement of Labour's approach, which was pretty cautious throughout the campaign. The Labour manifesto didn't offer much. But a win is a win. It was more about the Conservatives imploding with one of the worst campaigns we've ever seen from the Conservatives after years of turbulence. The Conservatives were started the campaign 20 percentage points down, and they ended it, you know, well down. They were never, ever going to be able to lay a glove on Labour during this campaign.
What about those Labour seats that were run close by Reform, by Nigel Farage's party? I mean, considering, I think there were, Reform came second in 103 seats, 93 of which were claimed by Labour. Considering Reform's main interest is the immigration issue, are we likely to see Labour MPs also raising that issue quite vocally as they try to stave off the threat from those Reform candidates?
Reform is a problem for both of the main parties, but it is much more of a problem for the Conservatives. The fact is that right of centre vote in British politics is now divided two ways, the Conservative Party and Reform both laying claim to that vote. And until the Conservative Party can claim those votes back from Reform, they'll be in opposition. They could be in opposition now for a generation, for so long as Reform remains an active party. It is true that, you know, Reform also depressed the Labour vote, but that put Reform into second place, as you say, in a lot of Labour seats. Reform was not capable of winning seats otherwise. The few seats that Reform managed to win were from the Conservatives. Mm. And there's no doubt that the Conservatives have got a decision to make now. Do they go closer to Nigel Farage as a consequence of this, or do they, you know, refuse to touch Nigel Farage in his politics with a barge pole? That will be the key now to who becomes the next Conservative Party leader and whether they can launch a Conservative revival.
Yes, and so what are the dynamics then at play within the Conservatives in relation to that question you just posed? Do you chase Nigel Farage and go head-to-head with him on issues like immigration, or do you move back to the centre to try and challenge Labour on the more bread-and-butter issues and cost of living and all of that? What are the dynamics at play, and are the Conservatives capable of resolving that question?
I don't think they are capable of resolving the question. They are divided internally on it. So you've got leadership contenders like Suella Braverman, who even during the campaign itself said, we should be more like Nigel Farage. We should be tougher on immigration. We should be offering tax cuts. We should withdraw from the European Convention of Human Rights. That's not the mainstream approach. And a lot of her leadership rivals, and I expect there to be quite a large number of contenders for the leadership crown, unattractive proposition, though it is at present. You had other voices saying we shouldn't be touching Nigel Farage, that we actually win elections from the centre-right rather than going further to the right. So that will be the ideological battle within the party. I suppose in terms of who wins, it depends whether Conservatives stick to their current rules. If they allow the members to have the final say after the parliamentarians have whittled down the final choice to two, then the members might be quite sympathetic to a lot of what Nigel Farage says. So they're likely to vote for a right-wing candidate. But there is talk that the Conservatives may change the rules and only allow the parliamentarians to exercise the choice, in which case you may get a more moderate next Conservative leader.
In Northern Ireland, which I know you were there on election night, we saw the big political shock in North Antrim. I think the last time someone not called Ian Paisley represented that constituency, the TVs were in black and white. So that tells you how long it was. It happened, though, on Friday with Jim Allister of the TUV taking that seat from Ian Paisley Jr. What does it say about the state of unionism in Northern Ireland right now?
Well, it just shows how fragmented unionism is. I mean, it was a huge, huge story, as you indicate. But now if you look at the Westminster seats held by unionists, yes, unionists have returned eight people to Westminster. So it's as you were in that sense. But you've got eight seats returning three different parties, plus an independent unionist. You know, the whole of England, 543 constituencies, only returned five parties to Westminster. Last Thursday, unionists have managed to get nearly that number just from their own seats. You've got the TUV fundamentally opposed to the post-Brexit trading arrangements. You've got the Ulster Unionist Party on the moderate wing of unionism. You've got the DUP somewhere in between. And you've got an independent unionist who is probably, you know, leaning ideologically towards the TUV. So until unionism can resolve that internal fragmentation, it's going to have a problem. And of course, you know, Sinn Féin did very, very well. Sinn Féin's vote share was up. They were very pleased. Their vote share was up more than 4%, and they increased their majorities in virtually every constituency that they hold. So, you know, the dynamics of unionism, whilst the overall unionist bloc vote relative to nationalism is largely unchanged. There's considerable party division within unionism.
All right, John Tong, thank you very much for that. That's John Tong, Professor of Politics at the University of Liverpool. We'll be talking more about the DUP and unionism with Alex Kane shortly. But first, I want to talk to Philip Blond, who was an advisor to former UK Prime Minister David Cameron and is on the line now. Philip Blond, thank you for joining us today. We know, obviously, that Brexit split the Tories down the middle. Where does the party stand now? Who does it represent today?
It's a very good question. The party lost votes on both left and right. And if the votes it lost on the left count double because they go to either Lib Dems or Labour. So if the Conservative Party are to have a future, they need to counter both. But it's at first sight, it's very difficult to see what could unify a voter who voted Reform with a voter who voted Labour or voted Lib Dem. That's kind of what any successful Conservative approach needs to cater to.
And that is precisely the question, isn't it, that will be asked when it comes to choosing the next leader, which is going to happen very soon. So what kind of a leader do the Tories need now? And I suppose a separate question, what are they likely to get?
Yeah, I mean, I argued back in 2010 that the future of the right was red Toryism, as I called it. That is that they needed to move left on economics and the state and right on culture. And if you look at that formula, that is, I think, the only successful formula that can bridge this kind of double threat, the threat from the right and the threat from the left. If you look at those who moved on the left, they moved around issues of competence, which people have been talking about today, but that's secondary. The primary issue is one of vision. They moved because the state has stopped working in Britain. The police are dysfunctional. The NHS barely works. The state has collapsed. And that is what forced many on the left to switch because they need the state to work. On the right, you had unconstrained immigration, often from cultures that are seen as hostile to kind of British values by those who voted Reform. So you have a cultural threat and you have an economic threat. And the economic threat, I think you can speak to both sides, but the real key is having a leader who can be both pro-state, so the old free market, anti-state, popular conservative offer needs to die. And Liz Truss, as the leader or the embodiment of that, lost her seat, as did many of the other central figures in that movement. So if conservatism is to have a future, and it's not certain it does, because the situation at the moment looks very much like the French situation, with the conservatives in the position of les républicains, who have been completely outmoded by the Rassemblement National, who are the right populists who are going to become the largest party today in the French Parliament. And that could happen to the conservatives. They could be completely outmoded. Farage is charismatic. He's charming. He paints in big pictures. He's not a technocrat. And the Tories
and there are some in the Tories who would like Nigel Farage to join the Conservatives. There are some who've suggested that, you know, he should be lured into the Tory party. Is that an idea which is likely to be given any serious consideration?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it is an existential threat to the Conservatives. They would be foolish not to consider unifying the right. The lesson of British political system is that if you divide the left, the right wins. If you divide the right, the left wins. That's the fundamental logic of a first-past-the-post non-PR system. It's difficult, though, because in essentially a five-way party system, which we now have, you have huge amounts of unfairness at play. So Reform gets more votes than the Lib Dems, but the Lib Dems have, what is it, 59 seats, 71. And Reform only five. So that's another pressure. But I do think they will have to either confront Reform by speaking to their policy agenda, or indeed have some sort of arrangement with Reform. And I can imagine something like the German right, where they have two different parties that agree not to compete against one another.
Philip, thank you for talking to us today. That's Philip Lawn, former advisor to David Cameron.